I'm Kelsey, and I am so excited today because joining me on the show is the one and only Terry Clark. She is going to be coming to downtown Newark Sunday, September 22nd, performing live at the Midland Theater. Tickets are available now at midlandtheater.org. Terry, thank you so much for joining us today. I feel like people always forget to ask this, but how are you doing? How's your year been?
Oh, it's been an amazing year. Are you kidding me? It feels kind of like this whole year of retrospection on my career and everything that's happened over the last 30 years, revisiting my hits with some of my favorite people in country music nowadays, and re-recording some of those. The opportunity to play the Ryman and headline that venue for the first time a couple weeks ago. CMA Fest, being on the TV show with Lainey Wilson. It's just been a year full of really memorable moments and so many great relationships and fun times.
It really sounds like it's been quite an exciting year, and I definitely have a few questions for you about some of the things that you hit on as well. This week, we're actually playing some of your iconic 90s songs with our 90s at Noon segment, which we do every weekday at noon, as we gear up for the show this Sunday at the Midland Theater. Now, we do this segment each weekday at noon because we realize that people today love 90s country. Did you ever think, like back at the time in the 90s, that that era of country or that your music would be so influential to people and artists today?
I had no idea. I would have added a room onto my house. I mean, no, I don't think any of us had any idea that it was going to make that kind of a resurgence. And I just think a lot of what happens in life is full circle in any way. And I think that a lot of things that were cool one time become cool again, partly because of the new generation exposing younger people to it. Like, When you get guys like Luke Combs recording a song like Fast Car, which was a huge hit in the early 90s, and bringing new life to that, and Cole Swindell, sampling Jody's song. And just it all just brings an awareness to a certain era of music, not even just country music. Like, we're covering the New Radicals in my show, and we're covering a lot of songs that we're covering Springsteen and Huey Lewis and Led Zeppelin and Kenny Loggins. And like I said, the New Radicals, like, we've got mashups of songs with Dave Matthews and Sheryl Crow in the show. So we're reaching back even farther than the 90s into some other genres in my show, because I've realized, just how nostalgic people are.
Absolutely. I think a lot of people crave that nostalgia that you were mentioning. Now, back when you were younger, who was that for you? I know you mentioned a few people you're covering. Maybe those are some of your influences. But back then, who or what was your influence?
Well, when I was growing up, it was 80s country. So I was a big, big fan of early Reba, like early 80s Reba, and through the 80s, and artists that were really big during that time. Randy Travis, Ricky Skaggs. Gosh, I listened to a lot of Alabama. There was that 80s era, early into mid 80s, Janie Fricke and Gary Morris and Dan Seals. That just such an influential time on me as a young 13, 14, 15 year old. The Judds were huge for me. So those are the artists that really influenced who I became as an artist. But, after I moved to Nashville, especially, I started to expand my musical horizons, and I started listening to some different genres a little bit more. And I grew up with different genres because my mom was a big fan of Linda Ronstadt and the Eagles and a lot of the folk era of the 60s and 70s, Joan Baez, Bob Dylan, the Beatles. So I grew up hearing a lot of that. So I think that musically I come from a lot of different, it's like a melting pot, but the 80s country definitely was my most influential era and genre.
I think that's the best way to be, like a melting pot of everything. And as we progress with country music, we see where a lot of influence are being pulled from and how it's really just creating its own progressive sound.
Absolutely.
I wanted to ask, you started out playing Nashville, I read, at 18. Was your first gig at Tootsie's?
Well, yeah, it was. We were doing the tourist thing, and it's hard to believe this was 37 years ago, but Lower Broadway, for a lot of people who come to Nashville now, seems everybody does. It's become kind of the little Vegas.
Right.
People who come down to Lower Broadway now, they're seeing a very different scene than it was in 1987. It was boarded up. It was very abandoned. A lot of these buildings that are now worth many, many millions of dollars couldn't, mm-hmm. I mean, they were abandoned, given up. And there were nothing but pawn shops and adult bookstores and things down there that it was sketchy. But Tootsie's has been there forever. So Tootsie's was there and it was only one floor at the time. Very basic. And the only people who really I saw coming into Tootsie's were local, you know, wannabe singer-songwriters. They were just hanging out at the watering hole. And then once in a while, a Greyhound bus or a tour bus full of, you know, elderly people would get off and they would come in on a tour stop to see Tootsie's Orchid Lounge. So I wanted to see it because I knew the history of Tootsie's and I knew that it was a huge deal in country music and it was a famous watering hole of singers and songwriters like Kris Kristofferson and Willie Nelson when they were, you know, struggling to get their big break. And so I wanted to experience it and go in and at least as a tourist. And I wound up on stage. The guy that was doing a solo show there let me get up and sing. And the place started to fill up. And the guy who owned it, who's Robert, who owns Robert's Western World now, was then the owner of Tootsie's. He hired me to come in and do my set there 3 days a week. And I played 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. because it was the safest time of day for me to be down there by myself. So that's what I did. And as you can imagine, the 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. slot at a bar isn't exactly the hot time to make money. So I left with a nearly empty kip jar more than once.
So you had no idea that you were going to perform when you went down there? You were just kind of having fun?
Yeah, exactly. And that's how it happened. And it's funny how one decision to go do something can change the trajectory of your life and can change your story. Like, I can't imagine, I don't know what would have happened if we hadn't gone into Tootsie's that day.
So when you went from Canada all the way to Nashville, were you going to chase a dream or were you just going to visit?
No, I went, my mom and her best friend drove me down in a Honda Civic with everything I owned in the back seat. And we came from Canada and they stayed for about a week to help me get set up. I was fully here to chase the dream. I wanted to, you know, I had plans since I was 14 that I was moving to Nashville when I graduated from high school. And I didn't have a green card. I was from a foreign country. So I took the city bus downtown to Tootsie's to play my shift. But before my mom and her best friend drove back up to Canada and left me here, we spent 2 days just kind of doing the tourist trap thing. You know, we went to the Hall of Fame and we went to the Grand Ole Opry to see a show and we went to Tootsie's Orchid Lounge. And I really wanted to see Tootsie's because I was a history buff on country music. So I knew the significance of the bar and what it meant. So we wound up in there and they were like, ask that guy if you can get up and sing. So that's what we did. And I wound up singing and I wound up getting offered a job playing for tips there. So that's how that whole thing happened. And that was sort of, you know, and I thought, of course, I'm going to get a record deal. That took 8 years. When something like that happens, you're just so green. You don't know how long things take and, you know, what the process is going to be. But I was excited about getting a job at the world-famous Tootsie's Orchid Lounge at the time.
Now, I know that you mentioned taking it about 8 years for you to get signed. Was that the point for you where you felt like you had made it? You know, some people, it's their first number one hit. For some people, it's when they sign the record deal. What was that moment like for you?
I don't think I felt like I really made it until Better Things to Do was in the top 10, top 5, and was climbing the charts. And then from that point on, for about the next 10 or 15 years, it was just a constant chasing the next hit, chasing the next, trying to keep hold on to that relevancy and not be a one-hit wonder, which thank God I wasn't, and was able to, you know, have a really good run at radio for about a decade. And, you know, that's more than a lot of people get. It's also less than some people get, but you know what? I don't think God gives you any more than you can handle. And I was, I am forever grateful and so humbled by what my career has afforded me in life and the places I've seen and the people I've met and the experiences I've been able to have.
That's so great. Now, as a woman in the industry, what kind of challenges did you face in your early years or maybe still today? And what do you hope for the future of women in country music?
Well, I think it's not a secret that women struggle more at radio. The charts are still very male dominated. They were a little more open. It was a little more spread out and even in the 90s, I would say, between the females and males on the charts. But when I was younger, you know, I don't have any bitterness in me about any of that. Like, I don't sit around focusing on, oh, well, it's, you know, so much harder for us. It, you know, I've talked to some of my female counterparts who are friends about it. We have discussions about it, but you don't focus on the negative. You know, I try to stay focused on what I've achieved, what I've been given, and the gratitude part of it for everything that has happened and all the good stuff. But, you know, I went early on, as you know, when I first came to town, being a woman, I think the biggest thing that was the concern was just my safety. You know, I was by myself waiting at bus stops and walking down Lower Broadway with a guitar, you know, and that part of it was probably more of a concern than being taken advantage of or not getting something because I was a woman. But, I was told by many labels that I auditioned for that they had their female quota met. Like, they couldn't sign enough. You're really great, but we can't sign you because we have these two other girls we need to break. Now, how many times have you heard, you know, that being said to a guy? We already have three guys. We can't sign another one. We need to sign a woman next. That doesn't happen. So that sort of thing was part of the rhetoric early on, was that a label could only have so many female artists at a time.
Absolutely. I feel like for women, there's a bigger strive to set yourself apart from the rest because you have to try almost a little harder to stand out.
Oh, yeah. Like, it is a very common saying that women have to, you know, work twice as hard for half the money. And I'm not going to say that's not true. I mean, we've got to really constantly, you know, stay up on our game. But boys just sell a lot of tickets, you know, they do. And that's just the reality of it. So we just have to put out the best quality product and music and the best show that we possibly can. And I'm always trying to keep my game up. I'm always changing my show. I'm trying to, you know, step it up every single year and make it energetic and fun and something for everyone, and connecting with the fans and the people that are there and spreading the joy and nostalgia and all the things that they bought the ticket for.
Absolutely. Let's talk about some of the badass women that you have on your It Takes Two album. How did you get paired with some of these iconic artists who joined you on the album?
Oh, gosh. Well, I had a wish list, right? So I just started asking people, and some people, you know, I already had a rapport with and knew really well, like Ashley McBride, and she jumped on board first. And then after that, I think we went to Lainey Wilson, and she said she would do it and wanted to do it. And, you know, Lauren Elena and Carly Pierce, like, all of these girls are like daughters of 90s country. They grew up with this era of music. And, you know, when I was in the studio with them, they already knew the songs and didn't even really need a lyric sheet, which was really cool. And the stories they told me about what the songs meant to them growing up. And I don't know, it kind of just gives you this really warm feeling of, you know, when you're out there in the trenches and you're struggling, and then you might feel like you're being forgotten for a while, and then you realize you're not. There's something really, really sweet about that. It almost feels like a new victory or a new milestone is reached in just knowing that your legacy landed in good hands.
Now, we won't make you pick a favorite, but was there anybody on the album, you know, female or male, was there anybody who brought something different than you expected them to when you guys recorded one of the songs?
I would say the Cody Johnson duet of I Just Want to Be Mad. You know, we recorded that track in a very, very different way, and Cody wasn't there for tracking, but we were very communicative via text and phone calls talking about it. So we recorded a very, very different sounding musical production on it. And when he came in and we started swapping lines on and off, it sounded like a conversation that the original version of the song was basically just me, the narrator, the woman being mad at her husband and saying, you know, it was just a one-sided thing. I want to be mad for a while. And so when Cody came in, they were both mad at each other. So we're swapping lines now and having a conversation between each other, and the guy's allowed to be mad too. It's not just the girl. So it really took on a very, very different tone. And that's why that track is probably, oh gosh, it's definitely close to being my favorite. And I also love the Ben Rector duet of Now That I Found You. Ben is not a country artist, but he is immensely talented and somebody I've been a fan of for a long time. And when we re-recorded Now That I Found You, to me, that sounds like it could be a hit all over again. It just has such a contemporary, cool, awesome, mature sound to it. It's just a different feel than the original version.
Well, it's a great album. I listened into it, and you know, you have a lot of immense talent in there in addition to yourself. I know that Cody Johnson, he's got a few CMA nominations as well, but you yourself also just got a CMA nomination for Weekly National Broadcast Personality of the Year for your radio show, Country Gold with Terry Clark. When did you become a radio girly?
Oh, gosh. It's been, 13 years now? 12? I started out on a morning show with Blair Garner, Chuck Wicks, and Sonny Sweeney back in 2013. And that was a Cumulus broadcast, sort of syndicated. It went all over America. And then they moved me to Country Gold, I believe, in 20, gosh, it was 8 years ago. Don't make me do math. So I started recording that show and interviewing other artists, and it was very 90s intensive. And I just left Country Gold, so the irony of getting nominated for the CMA just as I am exiting the door on the show is interesting. But you know what? I love doing the interviews. I love radio. I love the whole experience. And I'm, you know, I would always be open to any opportunity that comes along. And it's nice, you know, to be nominated again. This is, I think, the third or fourth nomination for broadcaster. I never won a CMA as an artist, so you never know, right?
Well, so far you've been having a great year. We hope to see you get your first CMA, and congratulations again, by the way. And, you know, you're still part of the radio family, even though you left. Who's taking over for you?
It's Steve Harmon, and he is a DJ out of Texas who has been doing radio for a really long time. And I haven't heard the show yet with his voice on it, but I'm sure he's going to do a great job.
Well, you know what they say, once you get bit by the radio bug, there's no going back. I have so many questions I want to ask you about your career, but a few more left. But you're busier than ever with some of your recent accomplishments, like headlining at the famous Ryman Auditorium for the first time. How was that?
Oh, it was unbelievable. It was, I got to tell you, Kelsey, I've played a lot of shows in my career, and I recently got to play Madison Square Garden and the Hollywood Bowl with Reba on tour last year. But headlining the Ryman is my absolute favorite show I've ever done in my entire career or life. There was something magic in the air that night. We had a horn section. I had special guests come up and sing with me. Ashley McBride and Trisha Yearwood showed up. Fans flew in from all over the place, people who have been with me all along my journey in my career. There was something just off the charts unbelievable about the energy in the room, and the Ryman Auditorium being the original home of the Grand Ole Opry, one of the best sounding rooms ever. Across the alley from Tootsie's, where I started off on a stool with a guitar playing for tips, everything about it was just, it was out of a fairy tale. And I soaked in every moment and absolutely loved it. And you know what? You can watch that show on Veeps for the next year, because we live streamed it, and it stays up online on Veeps. So if anybody wants to watch it, they can still watch it. But it was just, can't say enough about it. I'm still kind of buzzing from it, because it was only 2 weeks ago. So I'm still riding a high on that show.
That's amazing. Well, I hear that it's absolutely magical from anybody I've ever talked to about it. So that's why I had to ask. Absolutely. Now, was it your first time performing there, or just your first time headlining?
Just my first time headlining. I've been on the stage many times, but it's never been for, you know, more than two or three or four songs. Mm-hmm.
Well, Terry, I won't hold you up any longer. Thank you so much for being a part of the show today. We are looking forward to you bringing that Ryman High down to the Midland Theater this Sunday, September 22nd. For those of you who don't have your tickets to the show, go get them now at themidlandtheater.org. Ladies and gentlemen, the iconic Terry Clark.
Thanks, Kelsey. I'm looking forward to seeing everybody, and we're going to make a Sunday night feel like a Saturday night.